Welcome to the Buckmaster Show for Monday, the 7th of February, 2011. I am Bill Buckmaster, your host for the Buckmaster Show on KJLL AM 1330 and always on the World Wide Web at buckmastershow.com. We're live weekday mornings from 9 to 10. The program re-airs from 7 to 8 p.m. right here on KJLL The Jolt. The lineup for today's show includes a newsmaker interview with Jim Glock. Mr. Glock is the Director of Transportation for the City of Tucson. We'll have an update from the Community Food Bank. Then an award-winning science reporter talks about her new book on the scary infection known as MRSA. Plus, a conversation with Judy Burns, former head of the Tucson Unified School District Governing Board, now clerk of the TUSD Governing Board. The Buckmaster Show is primarily an interview-driven talk show, but of course, there's always room for listener comments and questions. Call us on the Buckmaster Show live line at 529-3508. My talented and lovely producer, Rosemary Brandt, would be happy to take your call, and perhaps you will have some questions for Jim Glock, who is the City of Tucson Transportation Director. And we do begin with transportation this morning. A front page story in yesterday, the Sunday Arizona Daily Star, Pima County could delay up to $240 million in voter-approved road construction because County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry is withholding $80 million for projects inside the city of Tucson. Let's talk now on the Buckmaster Show live line with Jim Glock. Mr. Glock, hello.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. And I want to begin with this piece that was in the paper by Rob O'Dell and Andrea Kelly about Mr. Huckleberry saying that basically the funding for city projects will be nixed at this point. However, projects outside the city in Pima County will go ahead. What's your response to this?
Well, the Pima County 1997 Highway User Revenue Bond election did include some funding for City of Tucson projects. And the city itself has utilized bonding against future revenues of its Highway User Revenue Fund. And that fund gains its revenue primarily from the gasoline tax that we all pay at the pump. 18 cents per gallon goes to the state and then winds its way back to local jurisdictions. And the challenge with respect to the county in allocating those particular funds at this point in time is that the revenue has dropped considerably with the economic decline that we've experienced, as well as we've seen the state legislature and government shift funding from the Highway User Revenue Fund to cover costs that were otherwise being paid for with the state's general fund. And so their ability to incur bonded indebtedness is curtailed at this point in time. Clearly, the county has priorities outside the city limits for what remaining bond funds it has. And so we're struggling with how to keep projects on schedule and secure those funds at such point in time in the future that they are able to sell them.
Mr. Huckleberry said he thinks Pima County will be in compliance with that funding schedule as long as the money is paid sometime before the year 2026, even though contractors, of course, are scheduled to finish the work long before that. Do you think the county is in compliance?
Well, I think he's referencing the RTA plan overall that did list specifically 35 roadway segments. And the goal of the RTA was to complete those segments in separate five-year increments, begin the construction on those segments. And I think what Mr. Huckleberry is pointing out is the statutes themselves don't have a requirement to begin those projects in those five-year periods, and so that if we begin those projects by the end of the 20-year RTA plan, we'd still be statutorily compliant overall. Clearly, from the City of Tucson's perspective, many of the projects that we are seeking county support for are needed now. We do see traffic congestion continuing to grow along those particular corridors, and the infrastructure on the existing roadways is clearly in decline and does need to be reconstructed.
It's 11 minutes past the hour, and on our Buckmaster Show, live line is Jim Glock. Mr. Glock heads up the City of Tucson's Department of Transportation. Now, the county's delay, I understand, Mr. Glock, could leave the city without the money to build three major roads in the next several years unless the RTA agrees to put up the county's portion so construction at least can begin on schedule. Let's go over in some detail, if you will, the projects, those three projects that are at risk.
Sure. There's county bond funds associated with Houghton Road, and Houghton is a very long project. It stretches from Tankaverde down to I-10, and it's funded over a number of those five-year periods that I referenced. And the county has a considerable amount of money. I believe it's $47 million of funds shown in the RTA plan being allocated towards that. When the funds that the county is supplying are applied to the project, I think, is the issue at hand. The RTA has a policy that when a project goes to construction is when they want to see the non-RTA dollars put to bear. That's a policy that may need to be readdressed if there is the capacity on the part of the RTA to have the early projects funded 100% with RTA dollars, and then later projects perhaps then funded with the majority of the county funding. But that then puts the RTA in the position of having to find funds as it's dealing with all the projects that it has under its purview and are also demanding funding to keep them on schedule as well.
So that's the expansion of Houghton Road between Interstate 10 and Tankaverde Road. Now, what's project number two?
Project number two is shown on the RTA plan is improvements to 22nd Street from I-10 to Keno Boulevard. There are county bond funds associated with the interchange of Keno and 22nd Street. And that project is nearing design completion. We are getting prepared to move forward into construction. And if we're unable to access the Pima County bond funds, we could see a delay. There again, the same scenario on Houghton exists at Keno 22nd. Is the ability for the county funds to come in later and the RTA funds to come in earlier is the question that will be asking both of those jurisdictions of whether or not that's supportable. And then the final project involving county bond funds is the Broadway Boulevard from downtown out to Country Club, and that's not nearly as far along. We're just beginning the planning phase associated with that. The RTA plan calls for us to begin construction on that by 2016, so we have some room to work through the issues on that particular project. It's Houghton and 22nd Street that are of most pressing concern, and we look forward to working with the RTA and the county to see whether or not there's any options that we can pursue to keep those on schedule.
City Councilman Kasachek was quoted in that Star article yesterday saying the funding shortfall is so severe, in his opinion, that local jurisdictions and the RTA might have to go back to voters to ask which projects they want to reconsider because of the funding shortfalls. Do you consider that a possibility?
Well, that's certainly up to the elected officials and the voters of Pima County whether they want to consider that. Again, we're only 5 years into the RTA plan, and while revenues are down as a result of the overall economic malaise we're all suffering with, who knows what's going to happen in the next 15. So it may be premature to have to do that, but it could be an eventuality.
How has the economy affected road jobs in the city of Tucson? Are we getting more bang for the buck, Mr. Glock?
It has hit us two ways. One, revenues are down, but as you point out, we are also seeing the local contractors who were enjoying a fair amount of work from the housing sector of our economy needing to find other work. And many of these contractors who are building roads and subdivisions know how to build our projects as well. And we're seeing bids coming in considerably less than what we would have 3 years ago. And so we're hoping that the revenue shortfall is balanced out a bit by these good bids that we're seeing. But again, as the economy picks up, those bid prices are going to pick up as well. And so we'll be continuing to struggle with available funding and the cost of doing these projects.
It's coming up on 17 minutes past the hour. Jim Glock is on the phone on the Buckmaster Show live line. City of Tucson now has the green light, as you know, Mr. Glock, to begin construction on the modern streetcar project and begin spending $63 million in what is known as Tiger money. That's transportation investment generating economic recovery money, known as the Tiger money. So where do we go from here? What's the next step?
Well, now we actually get our shovel in the dirt. The last milestone that we had was to complete our supplement to the environmental assessment under the National Environmental Policy Act. And it's interesting in that the National Environmental Policy Act prevents you, until you have approval through your environmental assessments, as literally put a shovel in the ground where you could conceivably pull up an artifact or run into some environmental contaminants. We've now addressed all the environmental issues associated with the project, had that green light go to construction, and our goal is to have all of the track work under construction by the end of this calendar year, a new bridge over the Santa Cruz River along the Cushing Street alignment under construction within the next 3 months, and make this a reality. And it's interesting to note, Bill, that we're already seeing from an economic recovery perspective, investments being made along the streetcar line. I believe the Unisource TEP headquarters building did locate along the streetcar line because of its impending construction. I've seen a number of student housing projects get underway as well. And so we are seeing the private sector step up because of the potential of the modern streetcar in the downtown.
There was an article today in the Arizona Daily Star about construction jobs really still lagging behind, Mr. Glock. And I'm wondering, are you going to try to use local contractors and local people as much as possible on this job?
We are structuring the construction packages so our local contractors can compete for those jobs. We're making sure that they're falling within their bonding capability, because every contractor who enters into a project like this has to have the financial backing to prove that they can get the job done. Given the fact that we are using federal funds, we can't have local preferences necessarily applied as a part of the project, but we're doing what we can to make sure that our local contractors have an edge. And many of our local contractors are affiliated with larger statewide and national contracting companies, so I'm cautiously optimistic that we will be going local with respect to that. And even if we have out-of-town contractors, they're going to be needing to hire local talent to get these jobs done.
More than 125,000 people live, work, and reside along the modern streetcar route. The Tucson Modern Streetcar will be a nearly 4-mile fixed rail transit system connecting Arizona Health Sciences Center, the University of Arizona, University Main Gate Square, 4th Avenue Shopping District, downtown Tucson, and the Mercado District Development Area. So you think the interest will come follow this as far economically along this route?
Bill, I think it's already there. We're seeing a number of properties that had laid dormant for years start to submit plans and offer development options for folks to consider investing in. So we will be seeing, I think, a fair amount of activity along the corridor. And in the case of the university is extraordinarily excited with respect to this potential. As you know, they are landlocked. They really haven't had an opportunity to grow. And while they've had interest in moving into the downtown for years, if not decades, the downtown with respect to the university has always been a little too far to walk and kind of too close to drive. You think about getting into your car in a parking structure, driving downtown, parking in a parking structure, getting out. It just has never been convenient. And this modern streetcar is going to provide the linkage between the University of Arizona and the downtown like we've never seen before. And you got to, I think the community needs to recognize that the downtown and the university are the two major economic engines and generators in the region, apart from Raytheon, And to link these two, I think, is going to prove to be a benefit to the community overall.
In the remaining few seconds, has the cold weather impacted your crews with the pothole task force?
So far, it has not necessarily made any potholes crop up, but we did have a lot of challenges this last week. And as folks, leaky pipes were leaking into our streets and ice was forming, we were running around making sure to get those abated so we didn't see any crashes out there.
And Jim Glock, what's your future with the Transportation Department? Still full speed ahead?
It's full speed ahead for the next 11 months. I will be leaving the city at the end of December, but I will be leaving it in good hands. I'm working with the manager on my succession planning and will remain in the community upon my departure.
We'll talk several times, I'm sure, before you do depart and go off to other endeavors. Jim Glock, best of luck. Thanks for being with us on the Buckmaster Show.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much. It's 22 minutes past the hour. This is Bill Buckmaster, Buckmaster Show on KJLL and Buckmaster Show. We'll talk about the Community Food Bank next.
The Arizona Inn is the only Tucson hotel named by Travel and Leisure magazine as one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. Located in Midtown, close to the University of Arizona, the Arizona Inn is located at 2200 East Elm Street and on the web at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn maintains AAA Four Diamond status for both the hotel and dining room, with Chef Allison serving up breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, with a featured menu and seasonal favorites. And because the Arizona Inn is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, founded by Arizona's first Congresswoman, Isabella Greenway, the Arizona Inn provides an historic backdrop for your next special event. Arizona Inn is the perfect setting for weddings, anniversary celebrations, or your next business meeting, and you can make your reservations online at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn, luxury and elegance in the heart of Tucson.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is your one-stop store for fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and Mont Blanc and other top-of-the-line writing instruments. Order online at sarnoffart.com or visit owner-operator Henry Sarnoff and his store staffed by artists, for artists, and those who seek the finest quality in everything art-related. Sarnoff Artist Materials, 2504 North Campbell, three blocks north of Grant, and always at sarnoffart.com.
Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero More, Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza, topped with the finest, freshest quality ingredients. Enjoy casual yet upscale dining while sampling our extensive boutique wine list. Vero More in Tucson at North Swan and Camp Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at veromorepizza.com. And coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Coming up on 25 minutes past the hour, this is the Buckmaster Show on KJLL and BuckmasterShow.com. One of the charities that Southern Arizonans and people around the country, and around the world for that matter, have been donating to in the wake of the January 8th Tucson shootings is the Community Food Bank in Tucson, where Bill Carnegie is the CEO. Mr. Carnegie joins us now on the Buckmaster Show live line. Bill Carnegie, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Bill. How are you this morning?
Very well, thank you. And I want to get an update from you on the response so far to the food bank since the shootings now almost a month ago here in Tucson.
Well, Bill, the total as of this morning, it doesn't include mail from over the weekend, naturally, but we're at $138,000.
That is amazing. Are you shocked by that number?
I am. You know, it's certainly more shocked by the events of January 8th, but the outpouring of response, and it's not just people locally. You know, as you said earlier, it's people across the United States and around the world. And our average donation, I believe, is $16.
And as far as that buying food, where will that money go to that's been donated?
Well, we want to do something special with this, and we're in touch with the family, and we have a couple of ideas that we've pitched. One is to remodel some space that we have here at the food bank to improve our outreach to clients for signing people up for food stamps and doing referrals and just other things that are beyond food. And that would entail remodeling some of our space downstairs. And our pitch to the family is that we call this the Gabrielle Giffords Family Assistance Center.
Sounds like a great idea. Bill Carnegie is the CEO of the Community Food Bank in Tucson. He's on the Buckmaster Show live line. Mr. Carnegie, as you know, the number of Arizona households receiving assistance from the program formerly known as food stamps has been steadily increasing since 2000. In 2009, the program helped provide adequate nutrition for more than 300,000 Arizona families. Clearly, the recession is contributing to this recent spike, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. Plus, you know, we're doing a lot of food stamp outreach, as are other organizations here in southern Arizona, and certainly the state is doing it as well. But I believe we have four people on staff now and one person working strictly in rural southern Arizona to try and make sure that people know that they have this important benefit.
I want to talk about the Miles neighborhood. The Miles neighborhood in Tucson is making news with its one can a week food donation program, where once a week residents place food donations on their front porches. This seems like a great idea, and I guess it's not unique to Tucson. It's been tried and very successfully in other places in the country.
It's spreading. It's going viral, as they say these days. But it's so easy to participate in this program and to conceptualize. I'm really surprised someone didn't think of it earlier, but we just had an inquiry from the Vail School District that's interested in doing something out there that's similar. So, and we've been contacted by numerous food banks across the country about how do you get this started, how do you do it, what are the details. And it's, you know, we got a local hero here, Peter Norback, that's out there doing this and driving around in his little convertible and picking up food. And it's a great, great concept.
If a neighborhood association wants to get involved, how do they do it?
All they have to do is give us a call at the food bank or go on our website, send in an inquiry, you know, like, I want to start this in my neighborhood, and we can give you all the information and connect you with Peter Norback, who's the founder of this thing, and he'll show you how to do it.
Let's talk in the remaining minute. Give us an update. Now, we are about 6 weeks into the new year. How are your donations looking as far? How are your shelves? Are they fully stocked right now? Or are you always in a need of more food?
Well, we're doing quite well right now, Bill. We just received a large donation from Fry's, two semi truckloads of cereal, and it's just couldn't have come at a better time. But you know, we still need 30,000 jars of peanut butter a month and 30,000 boxes of cereal. It's just that the numbers of people in need are not decreasing, and that's not going to change until people go back to work.
Bill Carnegie of the Food Bank, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Bill, thank you, and thank you to your listeners for all the support they provide both the community and the Community Food Bank.
Thank you so much. It's 30 minutes past the hour. CNN News is next. Then we're going to talk about the MRSA infection. That's next on the Buckmaster Show.
Listen up.
This is Tucson's Jolt.
Tucson's Jolt.
KJLL.
Now you're talking.
South Tucson.
CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Egypt's new cabinet is meeting for the first time today. The country's vice president met with opposition groups over the weekend, including the Muslim Brotherhood. Daniel Kurtzer, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, says that's something to worry about.
They're not a liberal, democratic, peace-seeking organization. They have had a very singular goal since their founding in 1928, and that's an Islamist state.
Protests are still going on in Cairo 2 weeks after they started. President Obama is trying to improve his relationship with the business community. He's speaking right now to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington. British Prime Minister David Cameron says it was wrong for the previous British government to tell Libya how to get the convicted Lockerbie bomber released from prison in Scotland. He was set free on compassionate grounds after being diagnosed with cancer. The most trusted name in news. This is CNN Radio.
Total customer care. That's what makes Midas different. It's how we get to know you and your car, explain things in a way you'll understand, and give you service and repair options that respect your budget. From routine maintenance like oil changes, tires, and brakes, to advanced engine diagnostics and major system repair. Come to Midas and see the difference Total Customer Care can make. People and prices you can trust. That's the Midas touch.
All right, sir, your new tires are all installed.
And how much do I owe you?
Let's see, 4 all-weather radials plus balance, alignment, and labor brings your total to $0.
Did you say zero?
Yep, it's free.
Thank you. From the bottom of my wallet.
Free is better. Do your simple federal return for free at TurboTax.com. It's free to prepare, free to print, and free to e-file. No wonder TurboTax is the most trusted brand of tax software in America. Visit TurboTax.com today. Trusted brand claim based on Intuit Commission survey, August 2010.
Listed on the National Register of Historic Places and founded by Isabella Greenway, Arizona's first congresswoman, the Arizona Inn is still the standard bearer for luxury hospitality in Midtown Tucson, just minutes from the University of Arizona. Founded in 1930, the Arizona Inn continues to win top honors for hospitality and dining. Travel and Leisure magazine names the Arizona Inn one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. And the Arizona Inn is proud of its AAA four diamond status for both the hotel and dining room. Whether it's for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or a private event, you can count on Chef Allison's featured seasonal culinary creations to please. The Arizona Inn, a special oasis of hospitality in Midtown Tucson, 2200 East Elm, and on the web at arizonainn.com.
Are you up for the challenge? It's the third annual Boot Camp Challenge, March 19th. Join Olympic athletes, local armed forces, and celebrities as we laugh, climb, crawl, walk, run, and work out boot camp style through a 5K run-walk obstacle course. To sign up as an individual or a team, go to beatcancerbootcamp.com or call 546-1601. For the Cancer Boot Camp Challenge, 7:30 Saturday morning, March 19th at Brandy Fenton Park. For strength, for health, for life, for fun.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tinca Verde, at the southwest corner of Tinca Verde and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Mell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tanca Verde, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery, on the corner of Tanca Verde and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
It is 35 minutes past the hour. This is the Buckmaster Show, brought to you in part by Flowers, Rieger & Associates Certified Public Accountants, located at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com. Flowers and Rieger, the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Well, MRSA kills at least 19,000 Americans a year, puts at least 369,000 in the hospital, and sends millions to doctors or emergency rooms and causes billions of dollars of additional spending in healthcare costs. More than 4 million Americans are unknowingly carriers, and according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, MRSA kills more people a year than AIDS, yet it wasn't until last month that the Infectious Disease Society of America published the first ever clinical practice guidelines for treating MRSA in adults and children. Joining us now on the Buckmaster Show, Liveline, is award-winning science journalist Maren McKenna, whose book Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, is just out in paperback. Ms. McKenna, thank you very much for being on the Buckmaster Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell me about how you got interested in MRSA, and tell us how you define MRSA.
Sure. So, so how I got interested in it is kind of an accident of what I do for a living, which is that I'm a public health journalist. I did that for a long time in newspapers. Now I write primarily for magazines, and I'm a blogger for Wired, where they call me Scary Disease Girl.
I won't ask you how that came about, other than the fact that MRSA is pretty scary, right?
It certainly is. So let's unpack for people what MRSA is, because people often kind of recognize the acronym, but they don't really know what it means. MRSA, or MRSA, is the short form of a designation for a bacterium that's incredibly common in our lives and in our environments. The SA part stands for Staphylococcus aureus, or most people would just say staph. That's a bacterium that likes to live on our bodies, often in sort of warm, damp, salty places like the front of our nostrils. And about a third of the population walks around at any time with staph on them without being made sick by it. It lives in balance with us on the outside of our bodies. When it gets into the inside of our bodies through a cut or a scrape or a surgical incision, it can really make us sick. And it was a common cause of death before we had antibiotics. Now, MRSA, that MR, describes what happened to staph once we had antibiotics. The M, methicillin, designates one drug that was the leading drug in what's now an enormously wide category of the most common drugs that we use in medicine every day. So when we say MRSA or MRSA or methicillin-resistant staph, what we're saying is that there is a bacterium that's incredibly common in our lives and environment that lives on us and can make us very sick and now is essentially immune to most of the antibiotics that we use in medicine every day.
Is part of the problem the overprescription of antibiotics by physicians?
That's such a good question. Resistance, the ability of bacteria to evolve so that they can protect themselves, is an inevitable process. Bacteria did that at each other before we came along. They made compounds that cleared out, killed other bacteria, cleared out living space for their descendants, helped them in sort of competition for food resources. We came along, took those compounds, took them into the lab, synthesized them, and called them antibiotics. But there are things that we do that make resistance, make that inevitable process so much worse. And the chief things are that we misuse antibiotics in human medicine by getting prescriptions for things that don't really need antibiotics or won't respond to them. And also we misuse antibiotics in agriculture by giving them to an incredibly wide array of animals in close confinement farming.
The bug bite, some people say that MRSA can sometimes manifest itself on something that would look like a simple mosquito bite or a spider bite.
That's right. I guarantee you, if you went into an emergency room today and said to a physician there, "I think I have a bad spider bite," the first thing that will come to mind for them is not spiders. The first thing is MRSA, and here's why. There's different strains of MRSA, and those strains have caused several overlapping epidemics over the past 50 years. First, there was the hospital epidemic. Now there's that much larger second community epidemic that causes that 7 million doctor visits a year that you mentioned. The way that community infection starts is on intact skin. You don't have to have a scrape or a cut or anything like that. And it starts as a little hot red spot. And most people think it's a spider bite. But in fact, what it is it's the first indication of infection with MRSA, creating toxins that break through the skin and cause inflammation to start.
Let's talk a bit about what can be done if someone does have a MRSA infection. I know there's been a lot of talk about garlic and the compound of garlic as being effective.
So one of the tricky things about MRSA is that it really has not been paid very much attention to. And that's a funny thing to say when you think about how enormous this epidemic is. But in fact, science is just kind of catching up to it in many ways, which is why those guidelines for treatment have only just come out, though we've been dealing with this for decades. What that means is that there isn't a lot of research yet on what's the best way to treat it, and especially what the best way to treat it is if you don't want to take antibiotics. So that means that things like garlic and silver and all the things that people turn to in a kind of alternative way if they don't want to use antibiotics, there's really no good research on what you should take or in what quantity you should take it to protect yourself. So if you have an infection, the thing that's most important to do is to keep very clean, to cover the wound, and if you have recurrent infections, to consider doing things that are collectively called decolonization, which means chasing the bug from its condition of stasis on your skin by washing with antiseptics, sometimes getting an antibiotic gel that you can put up your nose, doing things like bleaching your sheets and towels, and keeping especially your bathroom and your kitchen very, very clean.
Maren McKenna is on the Buckmaster Show live line. She's the author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. It's about coming up on 43 minutes past the hour on the Buckmaster Show. Hospitals are notorious breeding grounds of MRSA, and I know that the United Kingdom in their hospital system has had very good luck on screening everyone that comes into a hospital in the UK for MRSA.
Now, that's something that American medicine is really struggling with. So think again about how MRSA lives on your skin, and you often don't know that you have it, and it's not causing an infection right away. You can see how that would unknowingly make someone a cause of infection for other people. If someone comes into the hospital as a patient and they don't know they're carrying this germ, it could be transmitted to other patients by the healthcare workers or by some of the devices in the hospital. What has been done to stop that in Europe is to check everyone at the door of the hospital before they're admitted to see whether they are carrying the bug, and if so, to put them into isolation and treat them to clear it out of their system. We've been fighting in American medicine now for more than a decade. There are camps that are arguing it back and forth, saying it's too expensive, it's too specific to one organism, it ties them up too much with the rapid test device companies. But the reality is, it does work, and the way we know it works in America is that it's used by the Veterans Administration. All the VA hospitals in the U.S. do this kind of checking at the door, which is usually called search and destroy, and both their infection rates and their spending for healthcare infections has gone down as a result.
What advice do you have for some of the Buckmaster Show listeners who may be needing a procedure? They may be going into a facility for some kind of a hospital procedure. What should they do in advance to protect themselves?
So it's a really good question, and it's a really good idea to talk first to your doctor and second to the hospital where you're going, or to if it's an outpatient center or a surgery center or something like that. The thing that seems to make the most difference is really pressing the healthcare system about this, and here's why. Healthcare workers are very dedicated people. They are not careless, they're not stupid, they don't want to make people sick, but they're also very busy. And they can easily get distracted in their jobs. So what makes a difference is knowing that you are very alert to the cleanliness that they're going to exercise, or even that you have someone with you who's going to kind of keep an eye out for you. Sometimes if you're going to have surgery, your doctor will recommend something like taking antibiotics in advance or washing with special antiseptic soaps. Now, the important thing to mention there is it's not the kind of super-duper antibacterial soap that you can buy, say, in a supermarket. That stuff actually not a great idea to use because it kind of makes the resistance problem worse. But there are specific antiseptics that hospitals have access to that you can wash with, say, for a week before surgery that will kind of knock out the bacteria living on your skin and reduce your risk of having a surgical infection.
We have less than a minute. Where can folks get your book, The Super Bug, or Super Bug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA?
Anyone who's interested in this or would like more information is very welcome at my site, superbugthebook.com, where there are links to buy it through Amazon and also through indie bookstores, and also pages of resources on MRSA as well.
Maren McKenna, thank you very much for being on the Buckmaster Show Live Line. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up now on 46 minutes past the hour on the Buckmaster Show, Judy Burns of TUSD is waiting in the wings. She'll be in studio with me next as we continue on the Buckmaster Show.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is Tucson's award-winning destination for everything art-related, including fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and the world's best writing instruments. Visit owner-operator, artist Henry Sarnoff at 2504 North Campbell, three blocks north of Grant, and always at the easy-to-navigate website, sarnoffart.com. Because it takes an artist to know an artist's needs.
Vero Amore presents Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza using fresh homemade mozzarella and the finest quality toppings. Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero Amore, casual yet upscale dining with an extensive boutique wine list. Vero Amore in Tucson at North Swan and Cap Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at veroamorepizza.com. Coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tinka Verde, at the southwest corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Mell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tinka Verde, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery on the corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
Minutes past the hour. This is the Buckmaster Show on a Monday, and joining us on the Buckmaster Show, Judy Burns, longtime member of the governing board of the Tucson Unified School District. And Ms. Burns is the immediate past president of the board. Did I get that correct, Judy?
Yes.
And you're now the clerk. Is that
yes.
kind of like the vice president of the board, or what?
The clerk has lots of papers to sign, and they fill in if the president is not there.
Okay, well, it's great to see you. And
great
I want to
see you.
Thank you very much. I want to begin with the schools. We had quite a few TUSD schools and some of the other districts really hard hit by this record-setting
yeah.
freeze. I mean, any time in Tucson, Arizona, you get back-to-back days where it's 18 degrees in the morning, you got problems.
Yeah, and we had a lot of them, and there were about 30 schools closed on Friday. My report this morning is they're all open, but they're still keeping their eyes open for things that might happen once everything's going, you know, the water's being used and we had heat out. We had sprinkler systems that were frozen that caused alarms to go off. Everything had to be reset. There was flooding at some schools. It was a mess.
What happens when the kids miss a day like that? Where is that day made up? Because you do have to make it up, don't you?
Well, I haven't had that conversation with the superintendent yet. Everything had to happen very quickly this last week, but I'm sure they've figured out what they have to do. And I know it's a certain number of minutes, actually, or hours, and I believe we have more days than the state requires of us, so maybe we can make it up by adding some time to days. I'm not sure.
Let's talk about the big story continuing to be the ethnic studies controversy. Where is that right now?
Well, right now we have asked for an administrative hearing, which is part of the law. We want to understand where they think we're violating the law, because we don't understand. And until they clarify it, we're going to have a hard time figuring out what they want from us. We want to comply. I met with some of the teachers involved last week, and they absolutely assure me they comply with the law and that they intend to, and they comply with the state standards, and they teach American history, with a Mexican-American point of view.
But they are not teaching, in your opinion anyway, the overthrow of the United States government.
I have not heard that from anybody. And you know, what's interesting, you can take little phrases or sentences, words, out of a book or a resource material, and they may look inflammatory. But when you're in the classroom with the teacher and you see how the teacher is using those words, it makes a vast difference. It's not just words on paper. It makes a big difference on how these things are taught. And we're certainly not teaching the overthrow of the United States government.
You've been associated with the district. I shouldn't even take a guess. Tell me how many years you've been associated.
Well,
I'm going to say 20 years. That's
I've been a volunteer for 25 okay. years since right. my son started kindergarten, and I volunteered in many, many different ways, and for the last 10 years on the school board.
And you have seen really the ethnic studies program since it began. I mean, when this program was conceived, was there controversy when it was originally
no.
launched?
No, and actually, we were charged with bridging the gap, the achievement gap between our Hispanic students and everybody else, which has been huge. And this was something we put in place to try and achieve that bridge. So it's been actually very successful. It doesn't reach enough kids, and not early enough, maybe. But you talk to high school kids, and it's made a vast difference in their lives.
There's been a threat to cut off, what, almost $15 million from your budget. That's a huge chunk.
Yes, it is. And after being cut over $70 million in the last 2 years, it's something we can't afford to do. But we don't want to give up on our ethnic studies. We think we'll find a win-win situation where they will not feel they need to take money away from us. They will realize we're not violating the law, and that if we have to make some small concessions somewhere, we're ready to talk and compromise where we have to.
There was a full-page ad in the Arizona Republic yesterday in the Sunday paper. It's something called the Arizona Education Commitment. It's a nonpartisan initiative, and right at the top of the list of the supporters is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. These are people who really believe that the legislature has a mandate to fund education.
Yes.
And I'm just going to pull a quote from the Arizona Constitution. This is Article 11, Section 10. The legislature shall make appropriations to be met by taxation, as shall ensure the proper maintenance of all state educational institutions, and shall make such special appropriations as shall provide for their development and improvement. I'm telling you, it sounds like right in the Arizona Constitution is a mandate for our legislature to fund public education in this state.
And I know since I got on the board, I've often ask if we could file suit against them for not funding us properly when you realize we're under all the same demands every other school district in the country here in Arizona is, and there's terrific demands on education, public education right now, and accountability. And yet our funding is a third of some of the states. It's always near the bottom as far as funding, and we achieve much better than we're funded, but yet we're criticized, and numerous new laws came down last year that affect us, put more restraints on us, and we haven't given our teachers a penny in the last 3 years now. It's a pitiful situation.
It really is, because we're talking about the young people. This is the foundation of their life, a public education. These people, these young men and women, they have to have a proper foundation in life, and they have to have an education. Now, the State of the District Address is coming up by Dr. John Petticone. That will be February 21st at 6 p.m. at the Catalina Magnet High School Auditorium. Do you urge all citizens in the community to come out to this?
Yes, I do. The more involvement that we have from our community that wants to support us, especially, they need to hear what we're up against and what we're doing to try and combat it on less and less money every year.
Now, I want to quickly running out of time. Judy Burns is with us. She is the clerk of the TUSD Governing Board and the immediate past president. What's going to happen to those closed schools? What was the final number, Judy? Was it 9 schools that closed last year?
Yes, there were 9. There, we've actually hired consultants. We've started neighborhood committees and overall district committees to look at the usage of those schools. Some of it got delayed because we didn't have consistent leadership, but now we're working on it real closely, and we want to get them filled up with what the community wants to see there.
So right now those schools are closed down.
Yes.
But the playgrounds, are they still open to neighborhood children?
I believe they have been, yes.
What's going on with the decline in enrollment? Where are we right now with TUSD and declining enrollment?
I think we lost close to 2,000 kids for this year. And it's very discouraging, but yet also there's no jobs. So a lot of people have left the area or left the state. And we've seen this trend across the state, so it's not us alone here.
We're already into February. I'm sure you'll be thinking and already about the budget that's upcoming. You operate on a fiscal year budget. Is that budget talks, are they just around the corner?
Yes, they are. And so far, the news out of Phoenix is not too bad for us. It doesn't look like major cuts, but it still is going to be difficult to keep up or to increase anybody's salary, which is what we really need to do at this point.
How about the teacher contracts? Are they up for renewal?
Yes, they are, but it'll be a couple months, and we're not looking at a large reduction in force at this point, as far as I know.
And teachers, as you said, they haven't had a pay raise in, what, 3 years?
3 years, so I believe.
It's very difficult right now, your budget
very
situation.
Difficult. Very, very difficult.
Your budget has been cut what percentage over the past few years?
Well, I don't know what the percentage, but $70 million, I'll repeat, is a lot of money to find. And we've decimated our central staff. Everybody used to say it was too large. It's
oh,
not
yeah, they
anymore.
They used to say 1010 was top heavy.
Not anymore.
Judy Burns, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thank you very much, Judy Burns, the clerk and immediate past president of the TUSD Governing Board. We are quickly coming up to the top of the hour and the conclusion of the Monday Buckmaster Show on KJLL. And please check out our website. It looks terrific. BuckmasterShow.com. Have a great day.
Tucson's Jolt.
Tucson's Jolt.
KJLL, South Tucson.